Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Good evening, my fellow Americans. We now stand 10 years past the midpoint of a century that has witnessed 4 major wars among great nations. Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development. Yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the U.S.
Hey, good evening, everyone. My name is Martin Schatz, and I'm here with Amar Ahmad. And we want to thank you very much for joining us for this special session of the JFK Peace Speech Committee on the 60th anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination. We're pleased and honored to have Ray McGovern with us tonight to comment on President Kennedy's American University speech. Ray is a former CIA intelligence analyst and a co-founder of VIPS, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. As usual, we will first show the speech, and then we will have commentary and discussion. So without further ado, let's watch President Kennedy's American University speech.
There are few earthly things more beautiful than a university, wrote John Masefield in his tribute to English universities, and his words are equally true today. He did not refer to towers or to campuses. He admired the splendid beauty of a university because it was, he said, a place where those who hate ignorance may strive to know, where those who perceive truth may strive to make others see. I have therefore chosen this time and place to discuss a topic on which ignorance too often abounds and the truth too rarely perceived. And that is the most important topic on earth, peace. What kind of a peace do I mean, and what kind of a peace do we seek? Not a Pax Americana, enforced on the world by American weapons of war. Not the peace of the grave, or the security of the slave. I am talking about genuine peace, the kind of peace that makes life on earth worth living. They have the kind that enables men and nations to grow and to hope and build a better life for their children. Not merely peace for Americans, but peace for all men and women. Not merely peace in our time, but peace in all time. I speak of peace because of the new face of war. Total war makes no sense in an age where great powers can maintain large and relatively invulnerable nuclear forces and refuse to surrender without resort to those forces. It makes no sense in an age where a single nuclear weapon contains almost 10 times the explosive force delivered by all the Allied air forces in the Second World War. It makes no sense in an age when the deadly poisons produced by a nuclear exchange would be carried by wind and water and soil and seed to the far corners of the globe and to generations yet unborn. Today, the expenditure of billions of dollars every year on weapons acquired for the purpose of making sure we never need them is essential to the keeping of peace. But surely the acquisition of such idle stockpiles, which can only destroy and never create, is not the only, much less the most efficient, means of assuring peace. I speak of peace, therefore, as the necessary rational end of rational men. I realize the pursuit of peace is not as dramatic as the pursuit of war, and frequently the words of the pursuers fall on deaf ears, but we have no more urgent task. Some say that it is useless to speak of peace or world law or world disarmament, and that it will be useless until the leaders of the Soviet Union adopt a more enlightened attitude. I hope they do. I believe we can help them do it. But I also believe that we must re-examine our own attitudes as individuals and as a nation, for our attitude is as essential as theirs. And every graduate of this school, every thoughtful citizen who despairs of war and wishes to bring peace should begin by looking inward, by examining his own attitude towards the possibilities of peace, towards the Soviet Union, towards the course of the Cold War, and towards freedom and peace here at home. First, examine our attitude towards peace itself. Too many of us think it is impossible. Too many think it is unreal. But that is a dangerous, defeatist belief. It leads to the conclusion that war is inevitable, that mankind is doomed, that we are gripped by forces we cannot control. We need not accept that view. Our problems are man-made. Therefore, they can be solved by man, and man can be as big as he wants. No problem of human destiny is beyond human beings. Man's reason and spirit have often solved the seemingly unsolvable, and we believe they can do it again. I am not referring to the absolute, infinite concept of universal peace and goodwill, of which some fantasies and fanatics dream. I do not deny the value of hopes and dreams, but we merely invite discouragement and incredulity by making that our only and immediate goal. Let us focus instead on a more practical, more attainable peace, based not on a sudden revolution in human nature, but on a gradual evolution in human institutions, on a series of concrete actions and effective agreements which are in the interests of all concerned. There is no single simple key to this peace, no grand or magic formula to be adopted by one or two powers. Genuine peace must be the product of many nations, the sum of many acts. It must be dynamic, not static, changing to meet the challenge of each new generation. For for peace is a process, a way of solving problems. With such a peace, there will still be quarrels and conflicting interests, as there are within families and nations. World peace, like community peace, does not require that each man love his neighbor. It requires only that they live together in mutual tolerance, submitting their disputes to a just and peaceful settlement. And history teaches us that enmities between nations, as between individuals, do not last forever. However fixed our likes and dislikes may seem, the tide of time and events will often bring surprising changes in the relations between nations and neighbors. So let us persevere. Peace need not be impractical, and war need not be inevitable. By defining our goal more clearly, by making it seem more manageable and less remote, we can help all people to see it, to draw hope from it, and to move irresistibly towards it. And second, let us re-examine our attitude towards the Soviet Union. It is discouraging to think that their leaders may actually believe what their propagandists write. It is discouraging to read a recent authoritative Soviet text on military strategy and find on page after page wholly baseless and incredible claims, such as the allegation that American imperialist circles are preparing to unleash different types of war, that there is a very real threat of a preventative war being unleashed by American imperialists against the Soviet Union, and that the political aims, and I quote, of the American imperialists are to enslave economically and politically the European and other capitalist countries and to achieve world domination by means of aggressive war, unquote. Truly, as it was written long ago, the wicked flee when no man pursueth. Yet it is sad to read these Soviet statements to realize the extent of the gulf between us. But it is also a warning to the American people not to fall into the same trap as the Soviets, not to see only a distorted and desperate view of the other side, not to see conflict as inevitable, accommodation as impossible, and communication as nothing more than an exchange of threats. No government or social system is so evil that its people must be considered as lacking in virtue. As Americans, we find communism profoundly repugnant as a negation of personal freedom and dignity. But we can still hail the Russian people for their many achievements in science and space, in economic and industrial growth, in culture, in acts of courage. Among the many traits the peoples of our two countries have in common, none is stronger than our mutual abhorrence of war. Almost unique, among the major world powers, we have never been at war with each other. And no nation in the history of battle ever suffered more than the Soviet Union in the Second World War. At least 20 million lost their lives. Countless millions of homes and families were burned or sacked. A third of the nation's territory, including two-thirds of its industrial base, was turned into a wasteland, a loss equivalent to the destruction of this country east of Chicago. Today, should total war ever break out again, no matter how, our two countries will be the primary target. It is an ironic but accurate fact that the two strongest powers are the two in the most danger of devastation. All we have built, all we have worked for, would be destroyed in the first 24 hours. And even in the Cold War, which brings burdens and dangers to so many countries, including this nation's closest allies, our two countries bear the heaviest burdens. For we are both devoting massive sums of money to weapons that could be better devoted to combat ignorance, poverty, and disease. We are both caught up in a vicious and dangerous cycle with suspicion on one side, breeding suspicion on the other, and new weapons begetting counterweapons. In short, both the United States and its allies, and the Soviet Union and its allies, have a mutually deep interest in a just and genuine peace and in holding the arms race. Agreements to this end are in the interests of the Soviet Union as well as ours. And even the most hostile nations can be relied upon to accept and keep those treaty obligations, and only those treaty obligations, which are in their own interest. So let us not be blind to our differences, but let us also direct attention to our common interests and the means by which those differences can be resolved. And if we cannot end now our differences, at least we can help make the world safe for diversity. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures, and we are all mortal. Third, let us reexamine our attitude towards the Cold War, remembering we're not engaged in a debate, seeking to pile up debating points. We are not here distributing blame or pointing the finger of judgment. We must deal with the world as it is and not as it might have been had the history of the last 18 years been different. We must therefore persevere in the search for peace in the hope that constructive changes within the communist bloc might bring within reach solutions which now seem beyond us. We must conduct our affairs in such a way that it becomes in the communist interest to agree on a genuine peace, and above all, while defending our own vital interests, nuclear powers must avert those confrontations which bring an adversary to a choice of either a humiliating retreat or a nuclear war. To adopt that kind of course in the nuclear age would be evidence only of the bankruptcy of our policy or of a collective death wish for the world. To secure these ends, America's weapons are non-provocative, carefully controlled, designed to deter, and capable of selective use. Our military forces are committed to peace and disciplined in self-restraint. Our diplomats are instructed to avoid unnecessary irritants, and purely rhetorical hostility. For we can seek a relaxation of tensions without relaxing our guard. And for our part, we do not need to use threats to prove we are resolute. We do not need to jam foreign broadcasts out of fear our faith will be eroded. We are unwilling to impose our system on any unwilling people. But we are willing and able to engage in peaceful competition with any people on earth. Meanwhile, we seek to strengthen the United Nations to help solve its financial problems, to make it a more effective instrument for peace, to develop it into a genuine world security system, a system capable of resolving disputes on the basis of law, of ensuring the security of the large and the small, and of creating conditions under which arms can finally be abolished. At the same time, we seek to keep peace inside the non-communist world, where many nations, all of them our friends, are divided over issues which weaken Western unity, which invite communist intervention, or which threaten to erupt into war. Our efforts in West New Guinea, in the Congo, in the Middle East, and the Indian subcontinent have been persistent and patient despite criticism from both sides. We have also tried to set an example for others by seeking to adjust small but significant differences with our own closest neighbors in Mexico and Canada. Speaking of other nations, I wish to make one point clear. We are bound to many nations by alliances. These alliances exist because our concern and theirs substantially overlap. Our commitment to defend Western Europe and West Berlin, for example, stands undiminished because of the identity of our vital interests. The United States will make no deal with the Soviet Union at the expense of other nations and other peoples, not merely because they are our partners, but also because their interests and ours converge. Our interests converge, however, not only in defending the frontiers of freedom, but in pursuing the paths of peace. It is our hope and the purpose of Allied policy to convince the Soviet Union that she too should let each nation choose its own future, so long as that choice does not interfere with the choices of others. The communist drive to impose their political and economic system on others is the primary cause of world tension today. For there can be no doubt that if all nations could refrain from interfering in the self-determination of others, the peace would be much more assured. This will require a new effort to achieve world law, a new context for world discussions. It will require increased understanding between the Soviets and ourselves. An increased understanding will require increased contact and communication. One step in this direction is the proposed arrangement for a direct line between Moscow and Washington to avoid on each side the dangerous delays, misunderstandings, and misreadings of others' actions which might occur at a time of crisis. We have also been talking in Geneva about our first step measures of arms controls designed to limit the intensity of the arms race and reduce the risk of accidental war. Our primary long-range interest in Geneva, however, is general and complete disarmament, designed to take place by stages, permitting parallel political developments to build the new institutions of peace, which would take the place of arms. The pursuit of disarmament has been an effort of this government since the 1920s. It has been urgently sought by the past three administrations. And however dim the prospects are today, we intend to continue this effort, to continue it in order that all countries, including our own, can better grasp what the problems and the possibilities of disarmament are. The only major area of these negotiations where the end is in sight, yet where a fresh start is badly needed, is in a treaty to outlaw nuclear tests. The conclusion of such a treaty, so near and yet so far, would check the spiraling arms race in one of its most dangerous areas. It would place the nuclear powers in a position to deal more effectively with one of the greatest hazards which man faces in 1963, the further spread of nuclear arms. It would increase our security. It would decrease the prospects of war. Surely this goal is sufficiently important to require our steady pursuit, yielding neither to the temptation to give up the whole effort, nor the temptation to give up our insistence on vital and responsible safeguards. I'm taking this opportunity, therefore, to announce two important decisions in this regard. First, Chairman Khrushchev, Prime Minister McMillan, and I have agreed that high-level discussions will shortly begin in Moscow, looking towards early agreement on a comprehensive test ban treaty. Our hope must be tempered. Our hopes must be tempered with the caution of history, but with our hopes go the hopes of all mankind. Second, to make clear our good faith and solemn convictions on this matter, I now declare that the United States does not propose to conduct nuclear tests in the atmosphere so long as other states do not do so. We will not be the first to resume. Such a declaration is no substitute for a formal binding treaty, but I hope it will help us achieve one. Nor would such a treaty be a substitute for disarmament, but I hope it will help us achieve it. Finally, my fellow Americans, let us examine our attitude towards peace and freedom here at home. The quality and spirit of our own society must justify and support our efforts abroad. We must show it in the dedication of our own lives, as many of you who are graduating today will have an opportunity to do by serving without pay in the Peace Corps abroad or in the proposed National Service Corps here at home. But wherever we are, we must all, in our daily lives, live up to the age-old faith that peace and freedom walk together. In too many of our cities today, the peace is not secure because freedom is incomplete. It is the responsibility of the executive branch at all levels of government, local, state, and national, to provide and protect that freedom for all of our citizens by all means within our authority. It is the responsibility of the legislative branch at all levels, wherever the authority is not now adequate, to make it adequate. And it is the responsibility of all citizens in all sections of this country to respect the rights of others and respect the law of the land. All this. All this is not unrelated to world peace. When a man's way please the Lord, the scriptures tell us, he maketh even his enemies to be at peace with him. And is not peace, in the last analysis, basically a matter of human rights, the right to live out our lives without fear of devastation, the right to breathe air as nature provided it, the right of future generations to a healthy existence? While we proceed to safeguard our national interests, let us also safeguard human interests. And the elimination of war and arms is clearly in the interests of both. No treaty, however much it may be to the advantage of all, however tightly it may be worded, can provide absolute security against the risks of deception and evasion. But it can, if it is sufficiently effective in its enforcement, and it is sufficiently in the interest of its signers, offer far more security and far fewer risks than an unabated, uncontrolled, unpredictable arms race. The United States, as the world knows, will never start a war. We do not want a war. We do not now expect a war. This generation of Americans has already had enough, more than enough, of war and hate and oppression. We shall be prepared if others wish it. We shall be alert to try to stop it. But we shall also do our part to build a world of peace where the weak are safe and the strong are just. We are not helpless before that task or hopeless of its success. Confident and unafraid, we must labor on, not towards a strategy of annihilation, but towards a strategy of peace.
Again, thank you to everybody for joining us this evening. Before I turn things over to Ray McGovern, we have something else to share. With Ray's permission, we've decided to show you a brief clip of another important activist for peace, Dr. Helen Caldicott, commenting on JFK's speech, which you've just seen. For those of you who may be too young to remember or to know about Dr. Caldicott, she has been for decades a leading voice of international physicians for the prevention of nuclear war. Our committee approached her this past summer for her thoughts about JFK's speech, only to find out that she had never seen it. So here is a brief part of her comments that we recorded on August 2nd, 2023, the day she first watched the speech you've just seen.
And every single thing that could happen or should happen to produce peace in the world, nuclear disarmament, end of nuclear testing, reaching out to Khrushchev, the whole thing. And I feel absolutely shattered because I've spent my life, along with Marty and everyone else, trying to save the planet from nuclear destruction. And we're on that course right now, in this instance. I don't really know what else to say except that this speech should be widely, widely, widely publicized. I've just sent it to my children, but it needs to go up on all the Facebook and Twitter pages and the like. I'm not sure how to do that with this speech, but it's a catastrophe beyond belief that he was killed. He was a man who stood up and said every single thing that was necessary to end the race towards nuclear annihilation. And they shot his brains out.
Ray, take it away.
Thank you very much, Marty. It's a sad day, actually, isn't it? And he blew his brains out. Well, where does that leave us? Well, I take hope or challenge, actually, from Rabbi Heschel, who very famously said, when injustice, think assassinations, take place, few are guilty, but all are responsible. Indifference to evil is more insidious than evil itself. I want to go back to the early days of the Kennedy administration, the call to many of us of an age to go down there and try to do something for our country. You know, that didn't sound corny then. Didn't sound corny at all. And I was in a little group of, we felt ourselves pretty well chosen. We were going to be the senior officers of the Central Intelligence Agency, right? And so we went into training around July of 1963. And we learned all the tradecraft, except we analysts who weren't going to be crashing cars or doing flaps and seals, we got to leave early. And just as a kind of a remembrance of how heady and how joyful those times were, I'm going to actually sing for you one stanza of the song that we put on for those operatives who had to stay at the farm, okay, for 10 more weeks to learn how to cars and stuff like that. And this is what we said. It was to the tune of Lady Marlene. All you have to know is that Madame New was Nguyen Xem's wife, but she was the éminence grise. She was the power behind the throne in Saigon. Here it goes. Goodbye to isolation. We have to leave the farm. We have to save the nation from tragedy and harm. We've all been trained as professional spies to tell foul lies to Chai Coms and Thais and pay Madame New. I see some smiles there. Here's the second stanza. Please, dear Mr. John McCone, won't you hear our plea? We worked our fingers to the bone for a very little fee. All we ask is permission from you to sell something to the GRU to help with our salary. And it went on like that. So Sam Adams, after whom the Sam Adams Award for Integrity and Intelligence, was one of our classmates. He composed that song, and he also showed that we were losing the war in Vietnam, and LBJ finally had to acknowledge that. Long story short, those were really heady days, you know? Those were days when youth was around in Washington, when it was just possible to have a new start. And that's precisely what I had, and my junior officer trainee colleagues also had, a new start. We finished the orientation. I have to mention here that toward the end of our orientation, we were treated to a diatribe by a senior operations officer who threw the book at the sitting president. He said he was a coward. He didn't rise to the occasion for the Bay of Pigs. He ought to be, he was so angry. And I remember filing that away in my head. Hello, this is really strange. This guy works for the same president I do. Well, file that away, folks. When I got my new job, wow, it was January of 1964. I had majored in Russian. I could do Russian. I taught Russian. And here I was analyzing relations between Russia and China. Okay, I was in this Soviet bloc area. Okay, think about that. It was the Soviet bloc. You know, China was on the Soviet bloc. Anyhow, we very soon realized what could happen there. The head of this area was a fellow named Fred Janning. He was sort of like two supervisors up. And he was kind of a morose guy. He very seldom, never smiled, except maybe if you tripped over something. And anyhow, he just really sort of curmudgeon, and he'll come into play in just a second. But let me just say that it never really dawned on me that those operatives on the other side of the turnstiles on every floor of headquarters building, those operatives who had their own little cafeteria on the first floor of the building, that they would have been responsible for assassinating a sitting president. Now I'm convinced that they were. The evidence is very, very plentiful and very persuasive. Now, when James Douglas wrote this book, JFK and the Unspeakable, he sent a hard copy around to all his friends in the Catholic Worker Movement, in the Church of the Savior Movement, hard copies. Everyone got one. Guess how long it took me to read it? Guess how long it took me to pick it up, okay? It took me like a year before I could read it because I knew what it said. And when I read it, I was appalled because it addresses the unspeakable. That was about 15 years ago. A couple of years later, there's another book, this one, Mary's Mosaic. And this was written by my former boss's son, Peter Janney, who I think may be on this call. Peter called me a couple of years after I had read Jim Douglas's book. I said, let's talk. He said, you know my father? Of course, he's one of my bosses. Well, I'm not going to spoil your reading this because this is a magnificent book. It's still getting hundreds of reviews, and it reads like a detective novel. It's what Peter Janney, Fred Janney's son, devoted most of his life to, okay? Read it, and you'll see that there were people, including his father, Fred Janney, who were involved in covering up the cover-up. Cover-up, of course, was the Warren Commission, let the CIA off scot-free. What happened was a woman named Mary Meyer, who was very, very close to President Kennedy, got disgusted at the Warren Commission report. She knew a whole lot. She was going to divulge it. She had a diary in which she kept all this stuff. She was killed. She was killed, shot on the CNO towpath in Georgetown a year later. The year after John Kennedy was killed. So this shows the people involved not only Fred Janney, but Jim Angleton and lots of other folks whose names you will recognize that were involved in covering up the cover-up. In other words, if Mary Meyer were allowed to live, this would be very dangerous for the CIA. What I want to do now is something a little different, something more granular. What I'd like to do is show you a slide from a memorandum written in 1967 when another cover-up had to be done lest somebody be convicted for being in a conspiracy, a CIA conspiracy, to assassinate President Kennedy. Amar, may we have that first slide, please? Okay, now you can see that old ABM script there. It's September 1967. What I would call your attention to is that this is the Garrison Group. Who's Garrison? Jim Garrison is prosecuting lots of people, including a fellow named Clay Shaw, you see at the bottom of that first paragraph. Now you have the executive director present, the general counsel. Mark that, the general counsel was there. And you have the worry about what's going to happen before, during, and after the trial of Clay Shaw. Who was Clay Shaw? Clay was involved in the conspiracy in some way to assassinate the president. May we have the next slide, please? Okay. General counsel, okay. His name is Larry Houston, by the way. He discussed his dealings with justice. Oh, they're going to get justice to help him, of course. And this is the important thing. Now, Ray Rocca was Jim Angleton's deputy, okay, big counterintelligence guy. After looking at all the facts and knowing about this Clay Shaw, he said, Garrison probably will indeed obtain a conviction of Shaw for conspiring in the assassinate President Kennedy. Whoa, I don't know if it comes through clear, but we're trying to put a little yellow on that because it deserves highlighting, so to speak. So the head of CIA says, well, if this goes through, if Garrison succeeds, then he probably will succeed in getting a conviction of all this thing is going to be, all this thing is going to be revealed. So what we have here, the next meeting of this august group. And if you look at the bottom of that memo, you have Fred Janney's signature. So Fred was the person that Dick Helms, the director, asked to chair this group. All the high muckety-mucks were in that meeting except the deputy director for intelligence, the one that does the analysis. They were, as usual, excluded. So what's going on here? We have the general counsel. The general counsel is all over this, and we know what Garrison thinks. Garrison would indeed. Rocca thinks Garrison, we had a conviction. Whoa. So the implications for the agency are huge. What to do? Well, the next meeting in this group the following week said, well, justice is going to handle this. We don't have to get directly involved. That would be a little unseemly. Justice will tell him to lie. And so this fellow lied and lied and lied very persuasively. The agency said, we'll back you up. Justice said, we'll back you up. And he was, after an hour, the jury acquitted him, okay? What's the backstory or the next story? Dick Helms, former director, admitted under oath in the deposition that sure, this guy, Clay Shaw, yeah, he worked for us for a long time. He was a very highly paid professional. Now, that was 10, 15 years after all this, after Clay Shaw got acquitted. So lie, and why lie? Well, so that the involvement of the CIA, in this case, in the person of Clay Shaw, would be kept secret. Next slide, please. Now, what about all this assassination? Well, you know, there was a cottage industry of assassins. I mean, Lumumba and Congo leaders and No Xin Ziem, and lots of people got assassinated. I mean, there were a whole bunch of mafia and other folks that were ready to do that. And was it okay to do that? Well, how about this specific genre of covert action? Well, one needs to know that the National Security Act of 1947, the one that created the CIA, says zero about covert action. All it says is that the CIA shall perform such other functions and duties related to intelligence affecting the national security as the National Security Council may from time to time direct. Okay. What is the National Security Council? That's an advisory board to the president. The president is the one who directs. The president is one who gives the orders. Okay. Next slide, please. What I want to say, just to finish up on this last point here, is that when you have, if you could, I don't know, Amar, if you can get that last slide back on there, but what you have here is, if you have a president who's able to do this, then you have a president who has his own personal Gestapo. And I use the word advisedly. Presidents can order torture. The torture techniques, the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques ordered by Bush and Cheney, it's a direct translation of Verschärfte Vernehmung in the Gestapo handbook, a handbook, okay? I mean, most of them, some of them were more enhanced than the Gestapo did. But, this is really serious. If the director of the Central Intelligence Agency believes that he can perform such other functions whenever the president issues, when the president says, hey, what, can you blow up the Nord Stream pipeline? Bill Burns, in this case, yes, sir, sure we can. And so they do. Can we do other things? Of course. Let's go to the next slide now, please. Now, watching all this, I have to say from a personal point of view, it's really hard, especially when the analysis part of the agency was corrupted to the point where we falsified information to justify, in quotes, a war on Iraq. Now, you don't have to take my word for that. For this, there was a five-year investigation by the Senate Intelligence Committee, and their conclusions were made available in June 2008. And this is what this bipartisan committee, I mean, the conclusions were bipartisan. Republicans signed on, as well as Democrats and Republicans, in making the case for war. The administration presented intelligence as fact when in reality it was unsubstantiated, contradicted, or even non-existent. Now, think about it, folks. What does non-existent intelligence look like? As a result, the American people were led to believe that the threat from Iraq was much greater than actually existed. Now, I adduce this because when this all happened, I was working downtown in a nonprofit, and I just decided to start writing, and we formed this Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and we started writing hurt on all this, but I was really just distraught that my former colleagues participated in this scandal, in this perversion of intelligence that Jay Rockefeller thought worth describing as intelligence unsubstantiated, contradicted, or even non-existent. And I said, I really ought to call it, this for what it is. We ought to get rid of the agency. And I said, well, maybe, get rid of there's a baby here. You don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I was so happy to be an analyst at the CIA before it became corrupted. I lived with the perpetual hope that it could be back that way again. So I was reluctant to throw the baby out with the bathwater. So next slide, please. I was vindicated. We came through. They got an honest guy in from the State Department to run an estimate on Iran, just as Bush and Cheney wanted to attack Iran on their way out of office. It's very clear, all right? Everybody was saying Iran's going to get a nuclear weapon. They're working on a nuclear weapon. And the NIE of November 2007 said, with high confidence, unanimously, Iran halted its nuclear weaponization work in 2003, and they haven't resumed that work. Now, why do I mention that? Well, I mention that because, McGovern says, you know, there's hope. The analysts can still do honest work. Next slide, please. Now, if I needed further proof, here's Bush acknowledging that this really was a terrible thing because it was eye-popping. These findings, they tied my hands on the military side. Now, he wrote that in his memoir. It's called Decision Points. They're parts of that thing that he wrote himself. Otherwise, nobody would have let him write these kinds of things. Yeah. After that NIE, how could I possibly explain using the military to destroy the nuclear facilities of a country that the U.S. intelligence says has no active nuclear weapons program? Bummer. He couldn't do it. What'd he do? Bush went to Israel two months later and complained about the, he said, the Israelis, I don't agree with what my intelligence analyst said, but they've said it and Congress knows about it. Which is really, really awful. Now, in his memoir, he finishes up and he says, you know, some people say that the intelligence of this kind was designed to influence policy. Whatever the explanation, the NIA had a big impact on what happened, okay? Not a good one. Now, the function of intelligence is to inform policy. So if you let the president know that Iran is not working on a nuclear weapon, that informs policy. If it influences policy, so the president says, I probably shouldn't attack you. Well, that's good. But the idea is just to serve up the facts, man, just the facts. And that's what they did. So I was elated. I said, well, maybe it's not irredeemable what has happened to the agency. Maybe we have the next slide, please. If you fast forward to when Trump was elected, and I want to leave adequate time for Q&A, so I'm not going to go on much longer. I just want to point out that when Trump was elected, despite mammoth attempts, subterranean attempts, illegal attempts, all kinds of attempts to make it not possible for him to win. I'm talking 2016, okay? It was judged necessary to make him kind of aware that he should know his place. And so Chuck Schumer, Rachel Maddow, and said, Rachel, let me on. I have a statement to make. So on the 2nd of January, 2017, Trump had not even been sworn in yet. Here's Chuck Schumer talking to Rachel Maddow. Watch carefully. It's only a minute, and it's on the final exam.
Ask you, I don't know if you have seen this. I don't want to blindside you with this. This is the latest tweet, as you were just saying. President-elect's latest yeah. Unsolicited pronouncement on the intelligence community. This was his tweet just a little while ago tonight. You see the scare quotes there. The intelligence briefing on so-called Russian hacking was delayed until Friday, perhaps more time needed to build a case. Very strange. We're actually told, intelligence sources tell NBC News since this tweet has been posted, that actually this intelligence briefing for the president-elect was always planned for Friday. It hasn't been delayed. Look. But he's taking these shots, this antagonism, yep. This taunting to the intelligence community.
You take on the intelligence community, they have six ways from Sunday of getting back at you. So even for a practical, supposedly hard-nosed businessman, he's being really dumb to do this.
What do you think the intelligence community would do if they were motivated?
I don't know, but I, from what I'm told, they are very upset with how he has treated them and talked about them. And we need the intelligence community. We don't know what's going on. Look at the Russian hacking. Without the intelligence community, we wouldn't have discovered it.
I mean, you all know enough about the Russian hacking, right? That the CrowdStrike firm who was deputized to look into the DNC computers about those emails from Hillary Clinton and the DAC, that he swore under oath in December of 2017 that there was no evidence, no technical evidence of any kind that anyone hacked the DNC computers. Not Russia, not anyone. Testimony, December 5th, 2017. Now, Adam Schiff, head of the House Intelligence Committee, kept that in his bottom drawer for 2.5 years until somebody told Trump, hey, Mr. Trump, you're president. You could probably get that testimony released. He said, oh, really? Yeah. So he got a new intelligence director in, and they say, the intelligence director said, look, Mr. Schiff, either you release that testimony or I'm going to do it tomorrow. Schiff released it. May 7th, 2020. What's now? November 22nd, 2023. Has that testimony or any articles about it appeared in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post? No. So the major media outdid Schiff in keeping this suppressed. So here is, ironically, Schumer saying, my God, if it weren't for the intelligence people, we would never know about the Russian hacking. Well, yeah, that's right, because they fabricated that. John Brennan and the rest of them, we can prove that. And I'm no friend of Trump. You don't have to be a friend of Trump, but you don't have to have Trump derangement syndrome so you can't understand what's really going on. Don't get me excited here, okay? Let me just finish here. You know, when you think about how the intelligence community has evolved, let's say evolved, you have Mike Pompeo, right? Now, I was recalling that four of our children went to the University of Virginia, great school, and they have an honor code. No, you can't lie, cheat, or steal, right? And you have to report people if you see that happening, but that only applies in Albemarle County, Virginia, right? So when I picked them up for Christmas or something, we were driving and we said, leaving Albemarle County. I said, okay, kids, now you can lie, cheat, and steal all you want, right? Because you're not a... Yeah, so, yeah, right, Dad, right, right. Well, Pompeo, there's an honor code at West Point, too. Now, Pompeo is a really good example of somebody who'd get all A's and flunk life, in my view. There must have been a sign there, leaving the West Point Reservation, and so you could lie, cheat, and steal. And he bragged about it. Now, why do I mention that? Because there's a court suit against Pompeo. He violated all manner of things, but it's demonstrably true that he violated the rights of folks who visited Julian Assange, because the CIA, through a cutout Spanish security agency, eavesdropped on those visitors to Julian Assange. Now, what will happen? Well, you know, it's problematic whether the judge will finally decide, well, national security, and let Pompeo off. But, you know, our country stands for those Bill of Rights, right? And the Fourth Amendment, you know, I have it here. Fourth Amendment, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue except upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation and particularly describing the place to be searched or the persons of things to be seized. The evidence is right out there that Pompeo thought that, you know, not only could he do this abroad, where he's entitled to under the charter of the CIA, but he could do that to American citizens who are trying to be legal advisors or otherwise supporters of Julian Assange. That's what we've come to. Pompeo, apparently, when he left the reservation there at West Point, said, phew, now I don't have to work for A's anymore, and I can lie, cheat, and steal. And then he bragged about that before some university in Texas A&M, and they all cheered, oh, yeah, you can lie, cheat, and steal. Well, what am I saying here? I'm saying the agency, as it's currently constituted, is corrupted through and through. It should be abolished. This is a good time to think about that. An agency that can assassinate sitting presidents, an agency that can get us into wars that, just by saying yes and by telling the president in this latest case, oh, yeah, Ukraine, oh, don't worry about it, President Biden. We take care of that. Russia is already losing, and the ineffectiveness of the Russian armed forces has been laid bare for the whole world to see. I'm quoting Bill Burns, head of the CIA, whom some of us kind of prayed would be an adult in the room. No, he's not. So what worth is the CIA? We ought to get rid of it. How do we do that? We got to figure out somehow to do that. And we have to kind of get together in small groups and not act alone, but do something. You know, what Rabbi Heschel said, you know, injustice takes place. Few are guilty. All are responsible. Indifference to evil is more insidious than evil itself. Now, there's lots more to discuss, a lot more on assassination and the various cover-ups. But I'm going to end now by quoting two of my favorite philosophers. One I had to learn in college, that was Aquinas, and he talked about the virtue of anger, okay? Got that? Anger can be a virtue, just enough of it to do something. He railed against what he called unreasoned patience. He said, unreasoned patience sows the seeds of vice, nourishes negligence, and encourages not only evil people, but good people to do evil. Now, it's been 60 years. Somebody said to me the other day, why do you care? Why should you care? You know, that's the question here. Why should we care? The last philosopher that I would like to cite is Winnie the Pooh. Okay. Now, Winnie said, you know, some people care an awful lot. Actually, they seem to care too much. I think that's called love. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ray. And we're going to turn to audience discussion in a moment. But before we do that, I wanted to just make a couple of announcements. As some of you know, the JFK Peace Speech Committee holds a webinar on the 10th of every month. And starting in December, our events will be hosted by Community Church of Boston instead of Massachusetts Peace Action. For this coming December 10th, we will have a distinguished expert in international law with us, Professor Alfred De Zayas, and he'll be joining us from Switzerland. And the session will be on Sunday, so it will start at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. And Amar is going to post a link in the chat that you could copy if you're interested in order to register for that event. Also, I wanted to mention that two members of our committee, Charlene Leahy and Sharon Abreu, along with Diane Doolittle, will be having a musical event this coming Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. This will include a showing of the JFK speech as well as their musical offerings in celebration of President Kennedy's efforts for peace. And it will be streamlined live on Facebook, and Charlene is going to put that link into the chat for everyone. Finally, I think, Amar, you had something you wanted to announce also.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Marty. And I'll make my announcement. I just want to say something first, and that's thank you to Ray for joining us today. And thank you, Marty, again, for putting this on. You know, the book you mentioned, Ray, JFK and the Unspeakable by Jim Douglas, you introduced me to this book. And it was only after I read it, after I read the book, then I realized that this book is actually dedicated to our moderator tonight, Marty Schatz. And Marty is a friend of Jim Douglas. And it was after that Marty and I started this JFK Peace Group that's been putting on these monthly events. So it's so nice to have you back with us tonight on the 60th anniversary of the assassination of President John Kennedy. And, you know, I just want to say, you know, learning from this book that Jim Douglas wrote, and from other sources as well, Marty's book and the public record, about our history as a country and about who John Kennedy was. And when I wrote a letter to James Douglas, I wrote in the letter that the story of John Kennedy, to me, it reminds me of the stories that I read in the Quran, because the story of John Kennedy, it has lessons that I think are timeless. They can apply to any time and any place. Because his story, it's a story about courage and resilience and peace and a lot more. So, you know, I just wanted to say that on this day when we remember John F. Kennedy. I just want to also announce really quickly that on December 5th, we're putting on at Community Church of Boston an event featuring a speaker named Sami El Aryan. And he'll be joining us on Zoom from the Middle East. And Sami is, first of all, he's a friend of Ray McGovern's, which is a nice connection here. He's also his parents became refugees in 1948 when Israel was created during the Nakba, the catastrophe. And they had to relocate to Gaza. And eventually when Professor El Aryan, he came to the United States and became a university professor. And he also became a political prisoner of the United States. And he's a very brilliant geopolitical analyst. So we're going to have an event with him on December 5th at 12 p.m. noon, because he's joining us from the Middle East. So I just wanted to announce that. I'm sharing the link for that in the chat in a moment. So please join us if that interests you. So Ray, for our first question tonight, I'll pass it off to you to ask, tell us about Sami El Aryan, your friend, and also tell us about your analysis, please, about the conflict in Gaza and Israel and Palestine. And also, while we remember John Kennedy, what about our president today, Joe Biden? What's his position on these issues of war and peace?
Well, I want to keep it clean, Amar, so I'm not going to address Biden. Sami El Aryan is the epitome of what I think is a representative devotee of Islam. He's gentle, he's kind, he's smart as can be, and he was persecuted by U.S. justice officials mercilessly, put in all kinds of jails. I first met him at a jail in Southern Virginia, of all places. And he was all smiles. Oh, thanks for coming and blah, 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 blah. And then when he was under house arrest for a couple of years in Arlington, Virginia, he was real close. So I used to see him regularly. He's a model. He's heading up a university subsection in Istanbul, if I'm not mistaken. He had me talk to his folks about a year ago. Don't miss it. What is it, the 5th, I guess you said? I'll try to tune in as well at noon. Again, he's just a real mensch, if I could say that, and he's really worth listening to.
And can you also talk to us a little bit about the situation in Gaza?
Yeah, you know what I come back to is Netanyahu. Now, we know Netanyahu. What people may not know is that back in 2001, he was in a constituent's living room, and he was holding forth, and there was a video camera. And he said, now turn that off, turn that off. And guess what? This fellow forgot to turn it off. So what does Netanyahu say? He says, on video, we have it. It's available. We're going to make it so painful for the Arabs that they will never, never, never rise up. They will never have a chance. And one woman says, well, won't people call us occupiers then? And Netanyahu says, yeah, they call us occupiers. So what? So what? He says, you know, and this, get this, folks, this is on the final, okay? Netanyahu, 80% of the American people believe that we're great, are identified with Israel. 80% think we can do no wrong. That's absurd. End quote. Well, on that, I agree with Netanyahu. That is absurd. And we are tied in a way that has never been so stark before, in a very dangerous way, giving Israel the wherewithal to do genocide. Do not blanch before the word. It's going to come back to haunt us. And the sooner we can have a real ceasefire, and the sooner we can talk some sense into Joe Biden and the rest of that crew, the better. So anything we can do. I know here in Raleigh, which is a little dwarf, really, a little small town, even though it's the state capital, we had thousands come out for a rally in front of the governor's thing just last Thursday. And when the person running the rally said, now, if you're not Muslim and if you don't have any identification with Palestine, raise your hand. 90% of the people in that crowd raised their hand. Some of us still had those shawls on, but so anyhow, do it. Get out there. We have to talk some sense to these people, because it's not going to be very long before the Arabs and the Turks and the Iranians say enough. We're not going to tolerate any more of this genocide. That happened before. It happened during my lifetime. You don't have to do 6 million people. 1 million people is quite enough, thanks. Still genocide. Sorry, but I feel very strongly about that.
Thank you, Ray. Okay, we're going to open it up to the audience. And I see Jeffrey, you have your hand raised. Do you want to unmute?
Yes, I do. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
All right. I know most of what I'm asking is already in the chat, but I wanted to make one specific question, including, two to Amar, one to you, Martin, and one to Charles McGovern, Ray McGovern. I apologize for pronouncing your name wrong. Okay. The ones in the chat is in big bold. It's a big heading text. It says question for Ray McGovern. Can you find it in the chat while I speak it?
Go ahead. Let's limit you to one question, okay? Because there's a number of people, so. Why don't you ask Ray your question? Go ahead.
All right. Could putting JFK's ideals from his American University speech titled "The Strategy of Peace" into my idea for an educational political game that would be fun to play and help educate young people and adults on important social and political issues, help out the cause, if you know what I mean, for peace?
Sure. That would be a terrific idea.
You could put your thoughts in the chat from the chat box about that and your reaction if you like.
Okay.
Can I hear your thoughts about it? What you think of it? Think of the idea?
The idea is to use JFK's experience to teach young people. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, I believe so.
I think it's great. I mean, people don't know this stuff. I mean, it's not in the school books, you know? I mean, there is a very adulterated history in what my grandchildren are learning now. And I'm trying to get them interested in the real story. Some of them are actually interested in it, but there's so much going on. If they learn one history, then I can learn the real one. Thanks very much for your question.
Thank you. Next is Sathish Kumar. I'm sorry, I sort of mispronounced your name. Do you want to go ahead? You're muted. You have to unmute. Go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you
now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, with Richard Nixon, the tapes in the Oval Office that he was keeping, a lot of people asked, well, why didn't he not destroy it? Similarly, the CIA has been holding back, or the government has been holding back, a trove of documents related to the Kennedy assassination. They were originally supposed to be released. Trump tried to release them. They were not all of them were released. And how do we know that the most incriminating documents were never destroyed in the last 60 years? How do we know that these documents are actually there and not being released by the government, but that they haven't been destroyed? Because there was a question that was asked in the Nixon case, right? He had the tapes. He could have destroyed them. He didn't. And ultimately, he was caught. Similarly, the CIA, which is a master in the dark arts, they could have destroyed it. Or the most incriminating evidence, they could have destroyed it. And so my question is, how do we know that they haven't destroyed it?
That's a really, really good question, Sathish Kumar. We don't know, but it doesn't matter. We know enough, for God's sake. There are documentaries, there's sworn testimony, Jim Douglas's book, The Mary's Mosaic by Peter Janney. We know enough. We don't need those extra papers. It is very curious that they're being concealed because, I mean, unless people are older, younger than me, they're all dead, right? Okay, so, but my bottom line is we have enough, for God's sake. Isn't it enough that when Trump gets up in the morning, as he did in 2017, saying, well, today's the day I have to release the rest of the JFK assassination papers. So, and then in the afternoon, the same afternoon, if memory serves, he gets up and he says, and this is exactly what he said, I've talked with the CIA and the FBI, and they tell me I can't really release them all, so I'm just going to relief a segment of those things, and we'll revisit it in 6 months. So McGovern writes a little note in his calendar, check on this in 6 months. What happens in 6 months? Nada. Nietzsche will.
Yeah,
nothing. And so we have to hold these people accountable, if it's only to say, well, you know, are you so intimidated by the likes of Chuck Schumer and Rachel Maddow and the folks that did these operations against Trump, and the same folks who helped Biden win, let's face it, those 51 former intelligence directors that spoke out about Hunter's laptop and said, oh, it bore all the earmarks of a Russian intelligence disinformation operation. Did they check with the FBI that had that laptop for months and months before? No. They just played this game. So the intelligence community, active and retired, is thoroughly corrupted. What we need to do is make sure our fellow citizens know that and try to figure out ways to do something constructive so these things can be brought back into line or abolished, as I'm suggesting.
I want to just add one thing in answer to your question about the withholding of information. The idea that information is being withheld conveys the notion that we don't know what we need to know. By announcing that we have files which have not been released, we give the impression that you can't quite know what happened. That is the propaganda. The propaganda is that we don't have enough information when we do. And if you go to Douglas's book, you'll see we have plenty of information. It's not a question of what happened. It's known. We don't need any further information for the government to release about its own culpability in the assassination. Okay? Gerald, you want to unmute? Gerald Belsky?
Yes.
Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Welcome.
Great, thank you. I have two comments. One is about the JFK assassination, and one is about today, which I think are directly related in terms of John F. Kennedy. But in terms of Clay Shaw that you mentioned, one thing that's not so well known about him is not only was he part of the CIA, but he was the head of the World Trademark, which was part of an international assassination bureau called Permindex that was identified by the French intelligence as an assassination bureau tied to the attempts on de Gaulle. So the people in this international cartel, Permindex, included the head of one of the leaders of British intelligence, former top one, Lewis Mortimer Bloomfield. It included a variety of fascists from World War II, organized crime, essentially international banking cartels. This is what you might call the synarchy of international interests who were involved, who the CIA was working with, but who opposed John F. Kennedy's peace policy, the very speech that we heard tonight. Right. In terms of that approach, I would argue, as I'm sure most people would agree, that approach could solve the Mideast crisis today, if we took that approach of looking at what is the actual interests of Israel, not Netanyahu, what's the actual interest of the Palestinians. Now, with that said, I want to invite people to an event which my organization, the Schiller Institute, the International Peace Coalition, Humanity for Peace is going to have this Sunday, which Ray McGovern is going to be one of the speakers at, called No More War Crimes, Economic Development, Not Depopulation. And Helga LaRouche is going to speak from the Schiller Institute. She's calling for an immediate peace conference, given this limited opening of a limited ceasefire. Let's turn this into a permanent one. But what she's calling for worldwide is let's have a peace conference, as the Chinese have called for and others, where we can discuss the longer-term comprehensive solution, which would have to start with, I think, the approach that John F. Kennedy took. And I would add to that something he would totally be consistent with, which is peace through development. This was something that Mr. Lyndon LaRouche had long pushed, which is you've got to get the Israelis and the Arab nations and the Palestinians together around concrete water projects, infrastructure, development. And that's the basis for two states to exist, because they need water, they need infrastructure. And it's that approach to the nation state, which Kennedy clearly supported. De Gaulle was part of that same tradition of how can you work with nations to develop. And remember, De Gaulle had to change his view on Algeria. So people are capable of changing, just like Rabin changed his view. But today, I would say we need an immediate peace conference in line with what John F. Kennedy had to say. I'm going to post the invitation to this conference this Sunday at 11 a.m. for people to watch.
Hey, thank you very much, Gerald. Next up is Jean Jonas. You can unmute.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for taking my question. Thank you so much on mostly Judge Andrew Napolitano's talks and YouTube videos. Regarding this horrific situation in the Middle East right now, is there any possibility that at some point the U.S. may consider Israel to be more of a liability than an asset in the region?
Well, I think sane people would conclude that years ago. I don't know. how it works, but you know, we have the Israeli view dominating our media, certainly our Congress, and it's, and our president does not really seem to be compos mentis. Let me just put it that way. Did he not say to the gay today that he saw more that he saw Hamas having beheaded more children or something like that? I mean, he said that before he saw pictures, but then they said, well, there aren't any pictures. He must imagine it. You know, this is really crucial. If you imagine things, he might imagine those buttons on the nuclear codes. I just don't know what you do other than you say, well, what we do is get a well-educated citizenry, and we step out and we try to repair these things in whatever way we can. The only thing we shouldn't do is nothing.
Okay. Amar, you wanted to comment?
Yeah, Ray, I have a question. Can you update us on your perspective of the status of the war in Ukraine and the implications for the United States?
Yeah. Well, this is a tough one because contrary to what the president of the United States said 2 months ago, namely that Russia has already lost, Russia has already won. Now, in other words, it's 360 degrees around, 180 degrees wrong, okay? Now, if that's the case, and Ukrainians don't have any more shells for their artillery or their tanks, which they don't, if they have no more young men to man their defense lines, and they're using women now and people between the age of 17 and 70, latest I heard, well, you know, a humane approach to this would be to say, look, Mr. President, you know, fighting this war against Russia to the last Ukrainian just never was a good idea. It's not a humane thing to do. Let's knock it off. Now, over the past week, we've had Bill Burns, head of the CIA, who does negotiations secretly sometimes. And we've had our defense secretary, Austin, both visit Kiev. What did they tell Zelensky? Well, I don't know, but it has to be, look, Congress isn't giving us any more money, but we don't have any more shells to give you. We had some, but then we give it to Israel. You better figure out what to do now because we're just not being able to support you any longer. And so maybe you ought to talk to Russians. Now, Zelensky, pretty stubborn guy, he's not going to talk to the Russians, so maybe he needs to be moved aside. It's just, you know, it's come to the point where Biden and Blinken and Sullivan and Nuland realize that they've lost this thing despite their rhetoric. And what are they going to do because it's an election year coming up? If they lose the war, they lose the election, and my friends, they might lose their freedom. There's lots of evidence in various court documents showing that the Bidens were taking bribes, that Blinken orchestrated this thing with all these 51 intelligence directors to discredit the laptop that Hunter Biden had. And of course, Sullivan was responsible for the whole Russiagate thing. I mean, it wasn't Brennan and Comey working alone. They were taking this, and Comey admitted why he could take such liberties with the law in his book. And he said, and I quote, "I was operating in an environment where Hillary Rodham Clinton was sure to be the next president of the United States," period, end quote. Well, if you're operating in that environment, I mean, you take liberties with the law because when push comes to shove, you're never going to be prosecuted, and you might become Justice Secretary attorney general, or, you know. So in other words, these people were pretty venal and pretty small and looking at these things. They never thought Trump would win. And then when Trump did win, they mounted this massive, massive attack on any opportunity to repair relations with Russia, and to blacken him by saying he was in Putin's pocket. I hold no brief for Donald Trump, but, you know, fair is fair, honest is honest. That's what they did. And I think that both political parties are so corrupt now that I'm just really glad, for my own personal thing, is that Jill Stein is in a race now. I supported her last time. I think she has her head screwed on right. And I think that whatever the odds are, I have somebody that can be proud of voting for.
Okay. Well, I think we're going to conclude for tonight. And I want to thank you very much, Ray. Really appreciate your being with us. And again, we have in the chat the link to Dr. DeZayas' event, and also to the event on Sunday, the musical event. So I'm hoping that people will have copied that and will register for it. And we're looking forward to seeing you. So thanks, everyone, for attending.